Just thought we'd get together today and talk about a few things that we're hearing about in the industry. And I'm in a sales role, so I do
Okay.
initial conversations with rev cycle directors and VPs. And one of the things that keeps coming up over and over again is the mismatch denials and how they're finding ways to kind of manually tackle that. So it's kind of an overarching theme when I have my initial conversations. Are you
And
hearing?
what are they defining as a mismatch denial?
Pre-authorizations that don't match what happens at the end, you know, so when the surgery is completed out of medical necessity or clinical necessity, something else was done. So that authorization doesn't match. And then the payers that allow us to retro-authorize that, some payers don't care, some payers do, some payers allow us to do something about it in that very short window. So it's something that we've kind of honed in on because we've been hearing a lot about it, and our solution allows us, has a feature that can, because it's real time with
You know, what I'm hearing is not just that these pre-authorization mismatch denials are a huge issue, because it is for
it
everybody.
is.
You haven't talked to anybody who said, "Ah, we got that covered."
Right, right,
And
right.
if they did say that, they might be making that up. But what I'm additionally hearing is that they want to see the data for why they had a mismatch, right? They want to be able to see that and learn from it, and as you're saying, work back upstream to do a better job of doing pre-authorizations, right? So they see the ability to identify these pre-authorization mismatches and get them reauthorized in real time to be tremendously valuable from a
For
denials
sure.
prevention, right? But they also want to use that same data
Right.
to that day go and understand why they had a mismatch. Was it because you got in and you thought that they were going to have this and you find that plus this and so now you do something different, or the device you were going to use is not going to work for this particular patient and you have to change to something else? Or is it because the scheduler just is picking a CPT off a list and not picking the right ones, right? So when I talk to doctors, I like to try to be, they're all defensive, right? These are my people, right? They don't like to hear that they're doing something wrong, right? They will blame their schedulers, right? And so then it's a push this way and that. So I think one of the nice things that Milagro has been able to do is to maybe help with the root cause identification of this. And this goes back to our old consulting roots, right? How do you actually help your clients get better at what they do, not just do stuff for them that they don't have to do anymore, but how do they get better at their piece as well
And especially
to
with
improve
prior
their
auth
income?
denials, I mean, they're almost impossible, right? And there's only four denial codes that they use anyway, and they never tell you really what the true reason is, and then they have a gazillion reasons why they're not going to support it. And so I would totally agree with you, Dr. Hobbs, that getting to the root cause is so important, and prevention of prior auth denials is the key to getting the reimbursement for sure, especially with prior auth.
The other thing I'm hearing too, kind of as you get beyond just the actual prior auth, re-auth challenge at that level, but we're hearing from some of the service providers, the revenue cycle service providers who are providing coding services, that you then get another challenge of the whole facility side of it. So you might be able to deal with the professional side, getting that part reimbursed, but typically the facility gets left out in the cold because they don't have any mechanism for doing anything about it or even being aware of it. So what we're starting to see, because everybody is doing, they're trying to outsource, they're trying to get help, and they're trying to find ways with, I mean, I think the retro auth is just one of it. And the other piece of the puzzle is surgical coding is getting more complex. You're starting to see robotics, devices, other things, and there's a bigger shift that's moving from what was considered inpatient, things that I'm blown away sometimes what they're starting to consider an outpatient surgery now. So they're pushing down to ambulatory surgical centers to do the work. They're bringing surgeons in. That those ambulatory surgical centers may be owned by another group, right? And so it gets even more complex to deal with the denial, but also deal with the coding itself, right? Where is the skill set coming from? How do you actually man these things? And some of the things I'm hearing just on the street right now is they're talking to different people is the what used to work with outsourced, you know, have someone else do the coding for us and outsource it. It's not working anymore when you get into the complex surgeries and you get into the need to turn around things because things are moving towards the outpatient setting, which once was the inpatient setting. So there's kind of that pressure on the pre-auth and the re-auth, but there's also just the pressure on how do we make coding more efficient? And the human isn't going to be able to do it anymore. They have to look to automation. I think, Greg, you know, we started this, and our team on the Milagro side kind of started thinking about what really is autonomous coding? Like, how do we really define this and start describing what's going on out there? Because there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of AI that's trying to be thrown at the problem. But with the way the complexity is and the challenges and the move to outpatient from inpatient and all the pressure from the payers, that we're starting to look at automation as being able to really have a true platform. You have to see all of it. You have to know what the payer rules are. For real, you have to be able to scale and dynamically adopt all those changes for real. You have to really be able to do this, because if you can't, and a health system puts their trust in you as a service provider or as a technology, they can have a massive catastrophe on their hands if you can't do it truly autonomously. So that's a lot of what I'm starting at least to see as I'm talking to people is, what does it really mean, and what will it do for us, and how do we get over the fear factor of someone handing their coding to technology for real, right? And what does that really mean? I mean, that's what I'm saying. And Vanessa, I bet you see a lot and hear a lot of that too, right?
Yeah. Certainly. And seeing more and more of at the coding level, having to combine the billing guidelines, the reimbursement guidelines at the front. Whereas before we could have raw coders, just code, right? Don't think about the payer guidelines, you know, the modifier even, you know, as far as like 25 Aetnas in love with, you know, or whatever. But now we're really having to combine those and having to have the payer policy available to the coder at the time, because there's also really not a source of truth for some of these surgical codes, like you were saying, because the payers are allowed to frankly bastardize billing and coding guidelines. And so with some of these surgical codes, like you've been saying, the whole inpatient to outpatient, and then there's the argument there, you know, so it's like the payer wins, right? Because they're the one reimbursing. So really I've seen that as an interesting shift too. And frankly, you know, some coders being resistant to adopting reimbursement guidelines is like, but that's not how we code. I was like, well, sorry to tell you.
It's coming.
And you know, Vanessa, when you mentioned that one of the things that you recommend for your clients is to try and code multiple codes up front and get those authorized, are you finding that on the back end that is in fact helping? And also, is it making the like post procedure coding faster? So one of the options that we offer is like we can, for especially for our denials product, is that we can code and we can get you back the post-procedure CPT code within X amount of time post-procedure or by midnight or right. And part of it is due to payer requirements and part of it is just due to like what the hospital requests. But are you finding that in fact doing things like more effectively on the front end is affecting the back end?
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's only a handful of payers that will even look at a retro auth, right? After that procedure is done, you have reduced your possibility of payment a lot, depending on the payer, right? So yes, we've absolutely found and found that the payers are open to prior auth, you know, as long as it truly is related and you can explain why there's the possibility of going in and it you know, turning into something a little bit different because of what you find. But yes, absolutely, because you've got that prior auth with all the CPT codes, you said it was medically necessary. So fighting that medical necessity battle is so much easier, and winning a lot more. Denials are reduced, you know, some of it you're never going to be able to, you know, even when you do have a prior auth, you still get the denials. But yes, we have seen it. The ones who are willing to adopt it, because there are some that are not believers. They're like, no way. You know, it's like, okay, well, why don't you just try it first?
Yeah.
It's just like, but there definitely is a formula. So it's like, you know, if you have this one code, you know, it's not like you can auth a colonoscopy with a hip replacement, right? So it has to make sense. But right. But yeah, we've done up to five for one procedure, up to five CPT codes in addition, because of the possibility gets prior authed. And
I wonder how many people are actually doing that now, because you've used the example of GI, and Dr. Hobbs, you used that example in our demonstrations, because I think it's a good example. You're going in for a regular colonoscopy and you find something. I mean, a lot of times that happens. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's part of the reduction of denial rates we see already. You know, we see that it's a small number of re-auths. I mean, it can be a big number to the health system, you know, over the course of a year, but maybe I would just wonder, that's just something to talk about when we have these conversations.
Yeah. And the resistance often comes if their prior auth process is 100% human, like there's no automation. Oftentimes they are resistant, because sometimes, depending on the portal you're using, every single code has to be done individually, and it's just painstaking, you know, so they're just like, we don't have the time. Like, we barely have the time to auth one code, let alone five codes. So if it is totally manual, there can be a little resistance, but sometimes you can prove it just in the denials, right? So let's go back to your denials. Let's go back to your payers and the ones you're not able to recover. They're really resistant with a medical necessity appeal or whatever. And they're just like, forget it. You're not getting it. There's value in then just being focused. Like, okay, we're not going to do this for everybody, but let's be focused on the ones that are really eating at our revenue. And then there's that ROI, right? There's that justification to adding a little bit more time and effort into it. And test it out, right? Test it out, you know, maybe not do it for your whole volume, but test it out so you can see, you know, the returns on it. And then they're a little bit more open to it instead of it being all or nothing, right? Because then they're overwhelmed.
And I think that, like you said, and what we're seeing is this is really making the case for automation, because as organizationally, their coders have been there for a while, there are changes in the payer rules, there's updates in the payer rules, that those are where automation is really strong, right? And having a platform that doesn't have to be convinced or didn't do it the same way for the last 30 years, or doesn't quite like their manager, or right? Because these are the things that happen with the human intervention or attempt to make change. And this is what we're seeing and why we're getting a lot of surprising feedback and how many people have come to say, hey, we really want to learn more. Is I think because when you can step aside the human element and bring this autonomous process, and it's able to go grab the payer rule changes, it's able to understand those, quickly look at the re-auth or create a re-auth by immediately getting the post-operative note, already knowing what the pre-auth is, and telling the automation when you have these things happening, or when you're coding the case, because you know in our case we code it up front too, we do the coding as well. Do it in this manner, we're able to dramatically and quickly make a big change that has a dramatic effect. We have the example that we've been talking about lately is our friends over at Tampa General, who have been using this as initially as a pilot. So just for surgical specialties, they haven't even really distributed it into their ambulatory centers fully yet. But we just took four specialties within Tampa General Health System, and we came back with approximately, and this is kind of their own audit, if you will, of looking at the numbers themselves, about $3.7 million. That's approximations, right? Because there's a lot of things that can vary. But we looked at $3.7 million for every 10,000 surgeries that we were able to, they call it capital preservation. And this is simply just by injecting us in and, you know, creating the automation. And that's a dramatic impact to them, right? Because now that we've been doing it for 2 years and we're scaling that across the rest of the organization down into their ambulatory centers, you know, we had the benefit of just kind of seeing some of the things that are coming out of their own reports that they're bringing up to their leadership. It truly is millions of dollars that they're openly saying. And Vanessa, I think you said this, is we would not have caught this or had the time to deal with it or have the resources to process mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. This would have been left on the table, and mm-hmm. automation mm-hmm. truly made a huge difference for us. Mm-hmm. Right. So mm-hmm. I think that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's that story.
I think that's a good point, Tony. And I just want to move the conversation just a little bit, but along the same idea. So, you know, a lot of the solutions that we see health systems implementing are solutions that require more people or better trained people or people who are willing to adopt new things, right? The reality in the marketplace, on the other hand, is that this workforce is dwindling, right? There are fewer and fewer highly qualified coders out there. More and more offshore coding, where you can't walk down the hall and say to the coder, "Hey, you need to do this different with these type of cases for us." And when you get into the specialty areas, it becomes even more difficult, right? And you know, Tony, you were talking about the ACSs and the move to ACS, right? The original ACSs were all physician owned, mm-hmm. right? This was groups of surgeons who did joint ventures to create ambulatory surgery centers where A, they could keep more of their revenue, but the primary reason they did it was so they had better control of scheduling, so they could do it, they could operate when they wanted to, because OR time is that's a whole different topic that we're not going to get into, but there are a lot of motivations for that. But a lot of these surgeons did their own coding, and a lot of them still do their own coding, right? They don't know the payer rules. I guarantee you they're not spending any time at all following payer rules. Worrying about pre-authorizations, reauthorizations, none of that, right? They're doing what they've always done. And so, automation is inevitable.
Right.
It's inevitable. It's, you know, there's very few things in life we do the way we used to do 15 years ago now. Right. And so, from making coffee to whatever, right, you're not putting a pot on the stove anymore. So, automation is coming. How do we help, these health systems and ACSs be successful and adopt this. And I would argue that the key is that you have to be very good upfront, right?
Yep.
Right. You can't take a year, you know, be a year down the road and the health system still trying to figure out when they're going to start making money on this, right? Or gaining efficiency.
Oh, this is being recorded, but that's for the Epic projects, Greg. That's not for the Milagro project.
Yes, no, but my point is, this is what they've seen with technology implementations, right? And so I think it's critical that if you're going to do automation, you got to do it well up front. And you got to be able to get up and running fast. And Anna, that is one of the things that I think Milagro is unique at, because it is such an easy implementation. And we're not trying to boil the ocean. You know, we're picking specific areas, focusing on those and doing them well. And Vanessa, I'm interested in your thoughts about that, because I know you do a lot of consulting.
Can I inject just one thing to that whole discussion? Because I think one of the challenges too, and Vanessa, you probably know, you've seen this yourself, but when we talk about automation, right now we're talking about it in the context of the health system and the ambulatory center, or maybe the Omegas or the R1s of the world, the service providers, right? But what we aren't thinking about is the reality that automation is also showing up at the payer side. they're doing.
Buyers are way ahead of us.
They're way ahead. And so when we talk about automation, is it here yet? For the payers, absolutely. Right. It's starting to turn a little bit into kind of like Futurama, but the ultimate battlefield is going to be robots on the payer side talking to robots on the billing, on the health system side, literally talking to each other without humans involved at all, making these high level impactful negotiations based on this payer rule and that CPT and why this was done and how did you do it. And that is the reality. And it's in understanding that reality that the humans that are today on the health system side will not be able to, no matter how many classes they take or books they have or tabs they have in their coding book, will not be able to keep up with Google's ability to help a payer deny a claim, right? And or AWS or whatever these systems are. And so the message I think that needs to be taken out there, regardless of Milagro or any of us trying to help on the health system side, we're trying to help make a difference. The payers are trying to help stop that, right? Mm-hmm. And they're using tech today, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. right? And so that's a big, I think that's an awareness that needs to be brought in. It's already an unfair mm-hmm. playing ground, and it's just going to get worse. Mm-hmm. Waiting a year or two to figure out automation isn't going to help anybody on the health mm-hmm. system side.
Yeah. And from the, you know, this is a revenue cycle leader, you know, conversation. So, and those are my people, Dr. Oz.
Yeah.
So I would say that from our perspective, you know, as far as when automation comes in, we want to hear that it's going to improve the clean claim rate, basically, right? It's going to reduce our denials. It's not going to create more bottlenecks. It's not going to cause me to have right. to create another freaking spreadsheet that I have right. to manage. You know what I mean? Like yes. something that's, you know, so that's really the reassurance, right? Is like, you know, you say you can do this, which we've heard, you know, I've been doing this 30 years now, right? Sure. And I've seen a ton of demos. I've seen a ton of tech implemented, right. you know, and promises are made and they're not fulfilled. So I think that even if you show me a referral, it's like, it doesn't matter because we know each organization is unique. There's about 80% that's standard in all of this, but that 20%, man, it can just yeah. make or break a tech company, right? That part that needs to be customized and needs to be handled with care and frankly, respect. Like I get it. You are concerned about that 20% and really saying that to the customer, to your client, like that we care about this 20% that we know is a gap that we need to fill and we need to take care of it for you. So it doesn't impact your revenue. Exactly. It improves your revenue flow mm-hmm. and isn't causing more problems for you. And because it's like the, I always use the Spanx, you know, example where it's like, it may squeeze it in here, but it just goes to the top. You know what I'm saying? Like,